I'm Leonida Inge. This is Test It from WUNC, a look at what the day's challenges tell us about where we are, what we believe, and who we want to be in North Carolina and the South. Today, the name change game. The New South is littered with reminders of the Old South, a South with monuments, memorials, and other reminders of a time when those in charge built statues and placed names on buildings of those they admired, no matter how racist and wrong. For years, there were grumblings from students and alumni at the historically black North Carolina Central University in Durham about the name on the school's administration building, the name of segregationist North Carolina Governor Clyde Hoey. Well, that name changed last year, and the building on that college campus now bears the moniker of the school's founder, James E. Shepherd. Carolyn Green Boone is Shepherd's great-great-granddaughter.
I feel overwhelmed with joy and pride by this building being renamed the James E. Shepherd Administration Building. I am so extra proud that this movement was initiated by students.
A lot of people, did they realize this building's name needed to be changed? You know, like, did they know who Clyde Hoey was?
I think most people did not know about Governor, I don't know if it's pronounced Hoey or Hoey, but most people didn't understand that he was a staunch segregationist and that one of the reasons he gave us money was to keep us over here so we wouldn't try to come over there, you know, to UNC.
Speaking of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, the historically predominantly white school is in the middle of its own name change game. Last month, the school's Commission on History, Race, and a Way Forward recommended that four names be removed from UNC buildings: Charles Aycock, Julian Carr, Josephus Daniels, and Thomas Ruffin Sr. All of these men are believed to be white supremacists or slaveholders who practiced or advocated violence. The Southern Poverty Law Center tracks symbols of the Confederacy on public land and buildings across the country in its Whose Heritage Report. Since George Floyd was killed in May, 59 such symbols were removed or relocated from public spaces or renamed altogether. Names of Confederates, segregationists, and white supremacists on campus and government buildings have captured most of our attention when it comes to how institutions are reckoning with structural racism. But there are other facilities named after people and places with racist roots. Prisons all over the South.
Well, so, you know, I'm based in Houston, and the Texas prison system is one of few that names its prisons after people. A lot of states name them after towns or, you know, cardinal directions. And there's one in particular that had been bothering me for a few years because I knew that it was named after a plantation.
This is Carrie Blakinger. She's an investigative reporter for the Marshall Project, a news outlet that focuses on the criminal justice system. Blakinger recently looked into the names of prisons in the South and found that several are either named after or located on former plantations.
And actually, the thing that made it click for me was after Hurricane Harvey, I was interviewing someone in the prison system about some of the effects of Harvey, and one of them was that they lost a whole bunch of the cotton crop. And I was like, hold up. I know that Texas doesn't pay prisoners. Most states do something, you know, very minimal, just a few cents an hour. But Texas doesn't. And I was like, are you telling me that you guys have been forcing, you know, mostly black and brown men to grow cotton for no money? Because that doesn't sound great.
Wow. It almost makes me think that there was always this divine plan to move, especially black men, right off the fields where they were enslaved to prisons. And sometimes when people say that, you know, because they look at the numbers, you know, the disproportionate numbers of Black men in prison, it almost makes someone who may not even be educated think, you know, they meant to do this. You know, that people were meant to leave plantations, especially in the South, and even at the end of slavery, I guess, keep them on these plantations in some way, especially if you're going to give the plantation your name.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, when you read Southern history, when you read convict leasing history, it's very clear that it does seem intentional. And it's interesting, too, because I think that a lot of times when people now refer to prisons as slave labor, many mainstream readers might assume that that's sort of a radical or extremist position. But when you look at the fact that some of these prisons are located on land that has not relied on, you know, the labor of free paid workers ever, like, that's pretty striking.
Just a quick history lesson here. In 1865, the 13th Amendment legally abolished slavery. But after the Civil War, slavery took on a new name, convict leasing. Prisoners were forced to work on railways, coal mines, and plantations. They worked in horrible conditions without any pay or adequate care. Meanwhile, Southern states put laws into place known as Black Codes that unfairly targeted Black people for petty offenses. As a result, prisons across the South incarcerated people of color at staggering rates. Blakinger says over time, several prisons on former plantations changed their names. But one of the facilities that still bears the name of a plantation sits in northern North Carolina. Caledonia Correctional Institution has been in Halifax County since the late 1800s.
So some of this area is historically, you know, really impoverished. It was a rich area in plantation days and then, you know, has since been historically impoverished. And yet right in the middle of it, you have this prison with this name alluding to the sort of like plantation riches and fecundity. The land was originally owned by the Johnston and then the Cathcart families, and they named it Caledonia, which was this sort of mythologized name for Scotland. It's got this sort of, you know, allusion to the riches and promise of the land. And the land got broken up in the late 1800s, and the state bought it up piecemeal. And, you know, it's been used as a prison farm ever since. And it's one of few that has retained the name of the plantation, which seems to be an intentional choice. Like, there's a lot of other things you could choose to have named that facility. And, you know, they didn't. To their credit, though, that was one of few states that when I was asking for comment on the names and whether they'd ever considered changing them, that was one of the few states that actually responded, first of all. And second of all, responded to say that, you know, they were evaluating the name and, you know, the history and figuring out what they should change. So,
well, let's talk about, I guess, some other examples across the South. I guess even in Texas, the Gorey Unit. And its namesake, you know, Thomas J. Gorey.
Yeah, so he's a particularly problematic individual. The Gorey Unit is in the Huntsville area, which is sort of nerve center of the Texas prison system. We have 104 prisons here, and there's about seven in Huntsville and then two others right outside. And one of them is the Gorey Unit. Thomas Gorey himself was a Confederate, and he was a big plantation owner in the Huntsville area. And his actual former plantation is the site of another prison, the East Ham Unit, which is just outside of Huntsville in Midway, Texas. And he was a central figure in the convict leasing system, which was, you know, a brutal system of renting out prisoners and, you know, it killed thousands of people. And he was a slave owner himself. He presided over the prison system. He was one of the early prison system directors at a time when the system was formally segregated. And, you know, he actually thought of himself as a sort of, you know, benevolent master. But, you know, he was not. If you read, there's a book called Texas Tough, which is a really great history of the Texas prison system. And some of the accounts in there of the really horrific abuses that were occurring under convict leasing in Gorey's era are really, I mean, they're really horrifying. And that alone, aside from all of the other issues with this extremely problematic individual, you know, a Confederate, a slave owner, you know, oversaw convict leasing, like, aside from all that, just the fact that a prison is named after someone who was so willing to condone torture of prisoners seems like that in and of itself should be disqualifying. And I think part of the reason it's not is because it's a very niche part of history. Like, there's a very small group of people that can really dive into telling you what Thomas Gorey's role in Texas prison history is. Like, that's pretty niche.
When you think about changing the names of prisons, especially those in the South who are named after racist slaveholders, segregationists, are just named after the plantations that families owned at one point. Even if you change the name, it's still a prison. You know, it's still a prison. And, you know, how important is it to actually change the name now? It's almost the argument that people raise when they say, well, why take down that Confederate statue? You know, it's been there all this time. It's a part of our history. Why should it be removed? Are you hearing that as well when they say, like, why change the name of a prison now?
So, you know, this is really interesting to me. I mean, one of the things that comes up is that, you know, some people have been like, you know, to some extent, these names are maybe a little more honest about what these places are and what they stand for and, you know, what they do. But it's interesting. And obviously, this is a very limited group of people that I talk to. You know, I talked to, you know, a couple dozen people. I didn't do some broad survey. But all of the people who sort of suggested that this was more honest and that changing the names would be sort of whitewashing were white people. The people of color that I talked to in this did not think that, you know, the names should stay the same and were like, yes, you know, we, of course, decarceration, you'd like to close these places. But in the meantime, that doesn't mean we have to stick with these names. And I also talked to a number of prisoners and, they don't like living in a place that is named after a plantation. Like, they all understand that this is the reality. They are doing unpaid labor and, you know, under the threat of punishment if they don't. But there's some really dark symbolism in that.
So why do you think prisons haven't entered this mainstream conversation about, you know, changing the names on some of these, especially Southern prisons?
Well, I think that to some extent, people just don't know. You know, when you hear a name like Gorey, you know, your average person, it doesn't ring any bells. It's not like if you had the Robert E. Lee prison, which, I mean, in some sense, you actually kind of do, because I alluded to this, but in a lot of states, the prisons that are not named after, you know, people that are not named after wardens or governors or whatever, a lot of states are naming them after something geographic in the area, the county, the city. In the South, those names are a lot of times, you know, racists and Confederates and segregationists. And it's just like shooting fish in a barrel if you're looking through history of Southern names and trying to figure out which ones are problematic and racist and, you know, maybe shouldn't have things named after them. But I think a lot of the names that are named after wardens and prison officials, a lot of people just don't know what the history of these places are.
Carrie Blakinger is an investigative reporter for the Marshall Project. More in a moment.
There are things we're taught not to discuss in polite company. But by avoiding so-called impolite conversations, we're missing out on the chance to make important connections with each other. I'm Anita Rao, and I'm on a personal journey to uncover just what happens when we open ourselves up to talking about taboo topics that affect our bodies and our brains. Find out on Embodied, a new podcast about sex, relationships, and your health from WUNC.
The Democratic National Convention wrapped up Thursday after a busy week of virtual testimonies, galvanizing montages, and a historic speech from vice presidential nominee Kamala Harris.
That I am here tonight is a testament to the dedication of generations before me. Women and men who believed so fiercely in the promise of equality, liberty, and justice for all.
But one of the most memorable convention moments for me came earlier in the week. It was during Tuesday's remote roll call, when delegates from each state gave their vote for the nominee. It started off strong with the A's in front of the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Alabama, where civil rights icon John Lewis marched more than 50 years ago.
If we want to honor John Lewis's incredible life, let's restore the Voting Rights Act and ensure that our democracy belongs to all Americans.
As the camera cut from state to state down the alphabet, I watched the diverse lineup of delegates, each of them ready to issue their call to action.
New York.
As an immigrant from St. Vincent and the Grenadines and an 1199 SEIU registered nurse, I am proud to be part of America's fight against COVID-19.
North Dakota.
Kishkatni Dosha, Dosha, Jeed. Welcome to the homelands of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara people.
Northern Mariana Islands.
Half a day to row and hello from paradise, the Northern Mariana Islands. We may be far away, but we're American citizens. And this year, for the first time in decades, we finally have a Democratic slate. Because Democrats organize everywhere. But we don't get to vote for president, so please don't waste yours. The Northern Mariana Islands is proud to cast 2 votes for Senator Bernie Sanders and 9 votes for our next president, Joseph Biden.
So as a proud tribal member, as a Mexican-American, as a Harvard graduate, I am proud to cast North Dakota's votes. 10 for Bernie Sanders and 8 for our next president, Joe Biden.
44 votes for Bernie Sanders and 277 for our next president, Joe Biden. It's show time.
But among those states and territories in the ends, one of them stood out in my completely unbiased opinion. Yep, I'm talking about my home state.
North Carolina.
I've been doing this for a long time, so let me just be plain. Black people, especially black women, are the backbone of this party. And if we don't show up, Democrats don't get elected.
Let them hear it. That's Cozy Watkins in Charlotte, North Carolina. She's the Democratic Party chair of the state's 12th congressional district.
I'm putting on my mask and we're going to every corner in North Carolina to help organize because we need to make sure everyone shows up for Joe Biden. He will show up for us.
I've been watching the roll calls at the Democratic and Republican national conventions since at least the 1980s. It was the first time I was old enough to see and embrace a presidential candidate who looked like me. Remember Jesse Jackson in 84? Run, Jesse, run.
If in my high moments I have done some good, offered some service, shed some light, heal some wounds, rekindle some hope, or stir some wrong from apathy and indifference, or in any way along the way help somebody, then this campaign has not been in vain.
We already knew Reverend Jackson didn't have enough delegates to be the Democratic nominee, but we still sat glued to the television as the roll call commenced. I wonder who was watching this time around, glued to their screen as the lineup of black, brown, and indigenous people of color proudly stated their role in this race and in this country. That's it for this episode of Tested. I'm Leonita Inge. Charlie Shelton Ormond is our producer. Lindsay Foster Thomas is the executive producer. Thanks for listening.